dedicated to all the hackers and the crackers.
To the hackers and the crackers.
I see in binary, I speak source code. Step on my toes, I'll post a million JPEGs of you in a fag pose. In your digital stance, getting firewalled ho. Cause I'm riding the net in my 6-4. I was a dick with my 56. Now with my cable, I'm able to get that stable. On the out, my name is Ace and I'm a Leo. On the digital highway, my name is Neo and I'm a hero. In a flash, I'll sue you on burning Dreamcast. You need some ISO? Let me through my hard drive rifle. Our exchange you could never stifle. In a digital hug, you just caught the love bug. I bootlegged your CD. I caused the fight between Un and Jay-Z. You see, G, it's all gonna be free. Whether we take it by force or we take it nicely. You feel that rattle in your bones? When I tell you we just hacked Dow Jones. And NASDAQ leaves you flat on your back. Cause I am he who loves to hack and crack. Cause I am he who loves to hack and crack.
This is dedicated to the hackers and the crackers. Serial code, source codes, ISOs, RANs, SIPs, SIPs. This is dedicated to the hackers and the crackers.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Binary Revolution Radio, episode number 153. And we are on High Speed this week because we don't have enough time to talk about what I'm in topics. I have no idea why I went into that mode, but for some reason I'm talking very fast today. And I'm going to slow down now and tell everybody that this is episode 153 of Binary Revolution Radio. I am Stank Dog, and we are coming to you on June 20th, 2006, episode 153. Now, let's see, 52 episodes in a season, 52 weeks in a year, so we did 52, 104, so 150, let's see, where are we going to do it, 158, is that right? No, wait a minute, my math's off. 52, 104, 156 will be the last episode of season 3, is that right?
Yes.
I need a calculator, I think. These numbers are getting too damn... Who thought we'd ever make it past two episodes, let alone 156, two seasons, three seasons? So, we are nearing the end of season three, and we have now made a pretty good transition, I think, into this new format of the show, and seems to be pretty successful based on the feedback that I have heard, so we are going to continue again this week. And what does the future hold for Binary Revolution Radio? Well, I don't know. For that matter, is there any future for Binary Revolution Radio? Is this it? Do we go out on season three with a swan song? Do we continue doing it? What do we do with the show? I guess the only way to find out is to stick around for the next few episodes and see what happens. That being said, our co-host this week to start off the show is Right Coast joining us once again. Welcome, my friend.
Hello, Interweb.
Interweb. Live. Okay, not live, but pseudo-live. All right, what are we going to talk about tonight? Actually, pretty much one... Well, there's one quick topic, I think, towards the end, but our main topic today is going to be... I hesitate to call it a review, because it's still such a new early release, so let's call it First Impressions of Windows Vista Beta 2. I think that's a little bit safer to say, because we haven't had a whole lot of time to dig into it in detail, but... You and I have both done a little bit of tinkering and reading about the subject matter, so what do you say
Correct.
We jump into it? Well, I guess, let's see, where to begin? Wow, this is kind of tough. I didn't think about actually flowcharting where to start with this. All right, well, okay, first of all, the install was pretty straightforward, nothing fancy, nothing confusing or new that I noticed there.
No, it's so, actually easier than the XP install.
You think so?
I do, sure.
Now, did you do a full install from on a fresh machine, or did you upgrade, or what?
I did a full install to a fresh machine.
Now, I installed...
But it wasn't Beta 2. It was actually Beta 1 that I did the full fresh install on.
Aha, okay. I actually had an old XP box, and I just put in the... Burned a DVD on another machine and put it in, and... ran the setup from there, which of course does a reboot and a full install, so I was kind of curious whether it took any of the settings or not.
That's actually more interesting, did it?
Well, I can't tell. It was the same thing you described. I did not have, it didn't prompt me for a whole lot of things. It was pretty smooth, simple, straightforward. You know what, let me preface this by saying the box that I ran this and tested this on was a, let's see, this is an old Dell, not that old, it's a P4, gosh, 2.8 or 3 gigahertz, somewhere in that range. I think it's a hyper-threaded processor. It only has 512 RAM, 512 megs of memory. This is to me a kind of prototypical or a standard box that you would find in anybody's home these days. People that are buying anything more high-end than that are hardcore gamers or hackers or somebody, you know, that knows what they're buying. But if anybody goes to a store, buys a computer off the shelf, your typical home user, I'm guessing, you know, in my opinion, probably has a box similar to the one that I just described. Maybe more memory, maybe with a gig of memory, but it has a, actually, funny enough, I didn't even have a DVD-ROM drive or a DVD burner or anything in it. It just had a CD-ROM burner. So I had to pull a DVD-ROM out of something else just to get the damn thing installed so it could recognize my DVD. So, nothing fancy, nothing fantastic, but it's a decently powerful box. I do not have any sort of video accelerator or anything like that in it, which actually is going to be something to talk about later on. But it does have an onboard Intel video card, you know, standard, normal, gets the job done as far as business day-to-day applications. It's not going to run any games, that's for sure. But there's nothing wrong with the video card. Everything looks fine.
Yeah, mine installed okay. It was obviously more powerful than yours. I had a, what was it again? Radeon 9600 in that one.
Hmm. Well, this is just to play with it and test it out a little bit. By the way, I don't have sweet iced tea today. I'm actually eating a grape freezer pop. So if you hear me once in a while munching away on that, I'm,
Change is good.
That's exactly right. We got to shake things up. A new format change. Now with Freezy Pops. That's what we should do. At Hope, we should take, like, a whole bunch of Freezy Pops and hand them out or something.
Hacker Pops.
There you go.
Image of ESR.
There you go. Well, what would make the Hacker Pop any different than a regular old Freezy Pop?
You could make it out of cornstarch and water and watch it change shape.
Okay. All right, well, that's, you know what, I think we're going to, don't expect any Freezy Pops at Hope. Don't get your hopes up. So the install process went pretty straightforward, pretty smooth. Let's see, create an account when you first start up, an administrator account, and regretfully, that's the one thing I wish I had tried before we had to do the show this week, was create a second account, another user account, because all I did was create the standard admin, and I've been doing everything playing around under that admin account. Did you by chance create a user account?
I used the default account that was in the install.
Yeah.
So I didn't create a plain user.
Yeah, me either. So I wish I had done that to see if all these dialogues and stuff would have been the same for that. And let's see, other than that, it's pretty much came up with no problems. And when it first installs and you see it for the first time, looks very much like Windows XP. Has a start menu at the bottom. It's not blue by default, big whoop-de-doo. But you see the start menu down there. You still have your taskbar. You still have your quick launch bar. You still have your standard, I don't know what you call them, task bars down there at the bottom for each application that you have open. I don't know.
Yeah, that works.
I don't know what the proper term for that is. I just realized that. I have no idea. And they work a little bit differently this time. When you click on it, instead of kind of cascading them up, it'll actually show you a little specific one of what's inside of that tab. You have multiple windows and stuff open. It's kind of hard to describe.
Yeah, very OS X-like.
Yeah. It's funny you mentioned that. A lot of the stuff seems to be borrowed from OS X. And following along that line, like one of the things is that it comes with a few new applications by default. The install, I noticed, has, I think it's just called Windows Mail or Microsoft Mail, I don't remember, but it has a mail client that built in with it. It's pretty much, what is their Outlook Express or whatever they call that? It's a branch of that.
Yeah, exactly.
But it does come with a mail client, which is kind of cool. And same thing with the calendar. It comes with a little calendar app, which didn't the OS X come with, what is it called, iCal or something like that?
iCal, yeah. I'm not an expert in OS X, but yes, it does have iCal.
Yeah, so they copied a few things from that, actually delivering you a few apps with it instead of just Minesweeper and Solitaire. Although, since I mentioned that, there are also a couple games that it comes with.
Did it come with Tux? Tux Racer?
No, I don't think that
one. Oh, no, it didn't.
I was surprised to not see that myself, but It didn't come with those stupid shareware apps like they did on the Plus Pack last year, but we won't go there. came with a few little games, no big deal, and some new screensavers, which some of which did not run because I don't have the graphics accelerator that I mentioned earlier, so whoop-de-freaking-do. And let's see, it does have a start menu, like I said, but what did you think? I mean, it still works kind of the same, but I didn't like the way... I like going to the all programs. I pretty much always do that because I use so many different programs. I go to the all programs and find what I want. Now it kind of... When you go to the all programs, it kind of slides over to this new... I don't even know how to describe it. You know what I'm talking about? This new way of showing you a list of your applications?
Yeah, it was like all programs was like right at the bottom, and it had a, you know, like a obviously different icon set up. Yeah, you're right. It was different.
Yeah,
it wasn't like a tree menu to the right where, you know, the old Windows 2000 style.
Yeah, it's almost like a mini Explorer type thing, but it's
exactly.
So tiny that I don't like it at all.
There's a term for it. I forget the OSX term for that, but it really reminds me of OSX's.
Oh, really?
File
See,
browser.
I did not know that. I don't have enough experience with the Mac world anyway either, so... Huh, that's interesting to know. Well, yeah, that's kind of annoying, but I decided to leave that. I'm forcing myself to leave everything with the defaults to make myself kind of learn how to use it and get used to it before I say I don't like it because, you know, human nature is to say you don't like anything that's different or that's changed, but I'm going to give it a chance and see how it goes.
I was actually thinking of Windows Live. That reminded me of the OS X file browser, not Vista. Sorry about that.
Oh, okay.
Yeah,
Windows
so
Live.
The Windows Live site looks just like it.
That's a subject for another show, probably, Windows Live. I might have to do one on that as well. I've been playing around with that a lot. Well, I'll tell you what do you think about... Well, did I miss it? Did you have anything else to add as far as the general aesthetic values of it? I mean, is there anything... Well, there's a sidebar. What did you think of the sidebar?
It's a good idea. What can you say about it? I mean, it's not a bad idea at all. It's not new, but it's not a bad idea.
Right, and it's optional. It's optional, but isn't that, if I'm not mistaken, I think that's something else stolen from OS X. Well, let's not say stolen. Let's say maybe inspired by.
Inspired by.
Yes, there we go. And they call them gadgets, I think, whereas in OS X
Windows is calling them gadgets.
What do they call them in OS X? I forget.
Widgets.
Widgets and gadgets. Yeah, gee, big difference. But you can download and put little applets or gadgets or whatever you want to call them, widgets, onto the taskbar. By default, it comes with a clock, and I think it browses through, like, wallpaper images or something. I think you can have a slideshow on it.
Bring over, you know, shortcuts to, say, you know, your documents folder and things like that.
Didn't even know that.
Websites, even, it acts like an active desktop does.
You know, actually, that's a good comparison. It does act very much like Active Desktop used to, which never, ever caught on, the Active Desktop thing. That was a horrible failure because it was so resource-intensive.
We use it at work on all the machines.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Wow. Well, the only thing that was kind of cool that I did like about it was the fact that you can add RSS feeds to it easily, so I don't have to open up a browser. I know that doesn't sound like a big chore, but... If you're just sitting there working and you have your sidebar up, especially if you have multiple monitors, if you have a two-monitor more system, you can leave that sidebar up all the time and just subscribe to your favorite RSS feeds, and you can sit there and work and glance over at the news headlines and stuff like that that come through. I don't know how it would react with RSS or with podcasts or feeds with attachments or anything like that. That might be interesting to try. But I think that's something that's really handy and would save a lot of time over the course of days and weeks of not having to open a browser to check out the latest news or headlines. Now, along the same lines, though, there's a lot of communication going on with the interweb from this version of Windows, I thought. Between the updates, between downloads, critical downloads, update, software updates, security updates, validation... To validate and make sure it activates. Activation, I guess, is probably a better word. The software that you've gotten. The feedback, quality control, RSS feeds, if you add some of those in there. The individual applications, whether they communicate back to a server. With .NET, they made that a lot more invisible, and more applications in the future are going to run over the Internet or at least interact with databases over the Internet. So
yes, they are.
There's going to be a lot of traffic going to and from your box. And that is the biggest, probably, difference, I would say, the most drastic change that I think most users are going to have to get used to. It's pretty invisible. There's not much getting used to, but that's going to be the biggest change as far as the way people think about it. You know, years ago, Microsoft said when Internet Explorer 1 came out was that they even, back then, they tried to integrate it with their local browser and integrate it with the operating system. They wanted to blur the lines between where your desktop ended and where the Internet began. And I think this is another big step towards that. If you're pulling information and running a lot of apps that invisibly behind the scenes communicate with the interweb to get their data, I think this is going to be the one that finally starts doing that a lot. So, a lot of it...
Steve's always been open about that being a goal of theirs, you know? They really wanted to try to, or they always have. It's been something they've been doing a long time now.
Yeah, well, and they give you a lot of chances to turn that stuff off. You know, it says, do you want to get automatic updates, and do you want to activate your product now? Well, you know what? If you don't activate it, it'll run for, what, 50 times or something, and then it will stop working. Or, you know, activate your copy of Windows or you won't get critical updates and stuff like that. So some of it is optional but not really optional. And you can turn a lot of the other stuff off, like the feedback and the, I don't know, obviously you don't have to start create RSS feeds or things like that. You can block a lot of that stuff. Or you can block stuff at the firewall level. But I'd be interested to see if somebody sniffed the traffic and see what kind of data is going back and forth that they don't allow you to turn off. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, for the enterprise one, they're really trying to push, you know, feedback agents and things like that. It's really something that they really want people to do. They have this grand plan where their OS is going to be great because everybody's going to be really cool. You know how everybody turns that off, including in an enterprise setting.
Right. Well, and, you know, this is a beta, so, of course, they want the feedback system on, but, yeah, I disabled it.
Sure.
You know, I don't want to send that stuff back to them. I mean, I'm sorry, I realize we're supposed to be beta testing it, but no. Sorry. And actually, you know what? Something else that I've noticed, and I need to spend a little bit more time playing with it, was I actually did have a kind of a pseudo crash on the system. So, you know, on previous versions, on XP and stuff of Windows, when you're application crashes, it says, do you want to connect to Microsoft to find out more information? Do you want to send this data, etc., etc.? Well, I actually had a crash already, again, a pseudo crash on Vista, where I opened up, I was purposely stressing it out. You know, I had probably 10, 12 apps open with only 512 of RAM. I had a bunch of stuff open, changing back and forth just to see how it would handle it and how slow it was, and boy, was it slow. When you really open it up like that. And I actually saw a message pop up, and I'm not comfortable with this. It popped up with a message saying, Explorer has stopped responding. And you know what? It flashed up there for just a second. It was your standard dialog box. And it didn't give me any options. It just was a dialog box. And then it says, attempting to repair. And then it says restarting explorer.exe. And it did it all on its own without my interacting, without my telling it to do that, without my authorizing it to do that. So it's got kind of a self-healing aspect to the whole thing, which I found curious, I guess is a good word.
I guarantee there's a group policy at it to turn that off, but that's probably something that most people would want.
Well, I mean, actually, that's a good question for you. How would you feel? I mean, if you have to maintain a bunch of these, do you want it to automatically heal itself? Wouldn't that just... It's kind of like error handling when you're a programmer. You want to write a lot of good error handling in there so that you know what the problem was and therefore you can program around it. You don't want to just hide the errors and have it try to automatically adapt without you knowing what caused it in the first damn place. So it kind of makes me nervous when it doesn't give you the control. Anything that takes away control, you know, I don't like. So how would you feel maintaining that or having to... Would you rather... Do you like that aspect of it, or would you rather...
I guess it's hard to say yes to that because of the reasons you just said. But that being said, if it works well and it makes your life easier to administer the network, then probably, yeah. As long as it works well. As long as, like you said, it's not hiding a critical error from being discovered. Well, in a way that, you know, really, you know, if it's trying to restart a network application over and over and, you know, colliding somewhere, who knows, but
right. That
wouldn't be a good thing. But I bet most applications, if it were seamless, yeah, I'd say that's okay.
Well, and like, you know, one of my worries was when it first happened, I'm like, what in the hell is it doing? I mean, anybody, well, maybe not. Some people who are listening have probably at some point in time had Explorer hang on them. And you go into Task Manager and kill Explorer and restart it. And when you do that, you know it kind of loses track of some of your applications that you had open. Some of your applications won't show up in the taskbar or in the task manager or anything like that. So it kind of isn't very good. Well, I was kind of surprised when I saw this. I'm like, I saw the start menu disappear, all the Explorer, which of course is the shell. All of that stuff fade away. The desktop icons disappear for a second as it basically restarted just the Explorer. But it seemed to come back fully intact. So it seemed to be okay at first glance.
Windows added Control-Alt-Backspace.
Windows self-healing. I don't know. It could be good, but like you said, what if it's disco? Didn't Windows have a problem recently where their antivirus, or was it the new Windows antivirus, or was it one of the other antivirus manufacturers that accidentally deleted something that it shouldn't have? And that's
I remember that vaguely.
Yeah, darn it. I wish I remembered exactly what it was, but you know, that's the danger of letting something, giving something complete trust and control to completely do whatever it wants on your system. So I'm hoping there's overrides, not only for that, but for a lot of things in general in Vista. Well, there's one other thing. Well, is there anything else that you wanted to talk about as far as the interface or anything like that? I know you've got a lot more in-depth information, I guess we'll call it.
Well, I guess the one thing that I really remember from using it when I did with the Beta 1 that is probably still there, I'd imagine, was Alt-Tab was different. It brought up like a dock on the bottom of the screen where it showed you little miniature versions of the windows that
yes.
you had open that you
right.
could scroll through by pressing Alt-Tab instead of just, you know, Alt-Tab changes your window to window to window
mm-hmm.
like it does normally or on, you know, former OS's, Windows OS's.
Right.
It brought up more of a OS X type dock where it showed like a live preview of the window.
Yeah, I don't think I had that in mind. I think you might have to have that graphics accelerator. That might be an Arrow thing.
Yeah, it does require Arrow, I'm
yeah,
sure of that.
Yeah, so I did not get that, but I do know what you're talking about. And down under the taskbar down there, I think it'll also give you a preview of your window. And again, I'm going
right.
to look in to see what kind of settings there are under the hood to see if I can turn on and off a lot of these features. But I tell you what, there's one other thing I want to talk about before we turn it over to you to talk about some other things is this new hardware rating system that they have. Have you played with that at all, where they give you a number between 1 and 5 to rank your hardware that you have in your machine?
No, I talked to you about it, but I didn't.
Yeah, now see, this thing is just, I don't know, this to me, I really think this could have been, and this is still beta, maybe they'll fix it, yeah right, by the time it releases. But basically what they do now is they give it a rating system, 1 through 5, on the different hardware aspects of the machine that you're running this on. So it queries, it pulls your machine to see what you're using, so it knows what kind of processor you have, for example. And it ranks 5 different things that I saw at first. I don't know if that's default or if that's the only 5 that it checked. So the first thing that it checks is your processor. Now, as I mentioned earlier, I have a P4 2.8, 2.8 or 3 gigahertz, somewhere again in that range. And out of a score of 1 to 5, it gave me, I believe, a 3.8. Or a 3.9 score for that, out of 5. So I guess 5 being, I don't know, a high-end 64-bit dual processor. I don't know exactly what it takes to get a 5. But a 3.8, 3.9 is a pretty decent score out of 5. So, stop right there, and if you think about that, that actually can be kind of a cool feature that you can go into the store. Now, I know a lot of people, most people listening to this show know how to read tech specs. You can go in and find, oh, it needs a this processor speed and this many megahertz and this much memory, et cetera, et cetera. But a lot of your everyday people, you know, your typical home user, doesn't know what a lot of that stuff means. And let's be honest, quite frankly, it has gotten more confusing now when it requires a 2.4 gigahertz or higher, but then you've got AMD measuring their stuff with different numbers, so it might not be a 2.4, even though it says 2400, and there are still some questions. So potentially this could be really cool that you can go to the store and say, if you're running Windows Vista, you need this score or higher. It's kind of like when you go to the fair or the amusement park, and it says you must be this tall to ride.
Yep.
That's basically what we got going on here. All right, so to me, that's kind of a good idea. I kind of like that. It eases things, and it gives you kind of a centralized... it's benchmarking is what it is, okay?
Well, centralized, like you said, unless it's a roving target.
Well, and yes, and that is the problem. Is well, and actually, let me go back. There's a couple other... there's not one just for processor, obviously. There's also one for memory. And the 512 RAM that I have in there, believe it or not, scored like a 3.6, 3.8 on this 5-point scale, which is higher than I would have expected. But it scored pretty well on that. On the disk drive, I think I have an 80-gig drive in this box, and all it has is the fresh Windows Vista install, and actually Office 2007 beta that I just installed fairly recently as well. But anyway, plenty of free space. So I think I also got a 3.7 score on that, somewhere in that range. And then where it takes a dive for me. It has two different scores, which, first of all, I don't know why it would do this. There's a score for the video card, I think it's called. And again, I have that very simple onboard Intel video card. I think it's got plenty of memory to it. It's not, you know, it's not a bad card per se. And I think it scored a 2.0, a 2 out of 5.
Right.
All right, that's fine. I didn't expect much. I know it's not a fancy card. But
right,
then
you probably have 32 megabytes of memory on it.
I believe that is.
64.
I think it is 32. But then it has another score for what they call a graphics card. Well, video card, graphics card, what's the fucking difference? You know? I mean, I know what they're getting at, obviously. It's they're looking for a gaming card is what they're looking for, an accelerator card.
Right, and a graphics accelerator.
And I don't have one in this box, so I scored a 1 on that one. And again, that's also probably why I can't use Arrow and some of those other advanced flair, the graphics features and stuff on it. So, all that's well and good. All those can be really useful. It combines all of them into one overall score for your entire computer. Well, my overall score with those five numbers that I just gave you, my overall score was a 1.0. Now, how is it that my system had... fours, almost four on most of the other things, the lowest score was a 1.0, no matter what the fucking weighting system is for this algorithm, it would have to be 100% to the graphics card, graphics accelerator score, and 0% to all the other scores to come out with a 1 overall score. So that overall score to me seems completely useless. It's absolutely a waste, and the overall score, if it's not useful... why have it? It just seems to defeat the point. I can't go into a store, for example, and try to buy, let's say, accounting software, for example. I have the memory, the powerful enough CPU and all that to run it, but if it says that it requires a 2.0, theoretically, I'm not supposed to be able to run that. Just because I don't have a graphics accelerator, which is irrelevant? So I'm not sure how that's going to work in real-world applications. Seems kind of dumb to me. What's going to end up happening, I think, is we're going to end up seeing boxes and software and stuff that's going to focus specifically on the individual scores. You need a 3.8 or higher on your processor score, and you need a 4.0 or higher on your memory score, you know, or a game is going to say you need a 4.0 or higher on your graphics accelerator card, et cetera, you know what I'm saying?
Yep.
And... which, again, kind of, sort of, maybe useful. It's going to... it makes it a little bit muddier than I think it should be, but, you know, I can still see that happening. But then, the announcement that Microsoft has already stated that this is going to be a moving measurement. Well, if it's going to move, what works today may not work tomorrow. I mean, if I've got a 3.8 score right now, and then 2 years from now, processors are much faster... what used to be a 3.8 score is not a 3.8 anymore. It's going to be lower. So that software that I bought and was working on a 3.8, now my system's only a 2.8 measurement. Theoretically, it won't work anymore. You know what I mean? It doesn't make sense logically. mathematically, that doesn't make sense. Unless they're going to simply keep the scores moving upwards. The 3.8 will stay consistent, but new processors will score in 9 instead of capping it at 5. That's possibly the case, but then you're also getting it further confused.
Or as they add service packs and more processors come out, your processor, for instance, becomes a 2.7.
Well, there are some problems with this scoring system.
And no, it is a problem, but I'm saying that would be another possibility. Not a good one,
right,
but that
right.
would be another
well, yeah,
that's, way they go.
Yeah, I don't... Again, it's beta. Maybe they'll make some changes to that. But there's one more thing that I found on that screen that really, I think, is going to be the biggest news or the biggest problem with this. And that is a little something called Microsoft Marketplace. Now, this, to me, is a lawsuit waiting to happen. Basically, what they're trying to do here is, on that page where it has all of your rankings and your scores of your system, there's a, in this page, this is an application that's built into the OS. This is not like a third, this is not a third-party application. This is not something you can put plugins to or modify or change in any way, shape, or form. It's a Microsoft embedded application, part of the operating system. Well, it has a little link in there that looks like what you would think that it links to the help file. It's got a little hyperlink in there. And when you click on that, basically what the link says is, click here to buy compatible software or hardware for your machine. And when you go there, basically what it does is it knows your scores, and it goes to Windows Marketplace and looks up to see, oh, well, we know you've got this score, so here's software that will work on, will run on your machine. Categorized just like anything else, or it knows that I only have a 1.0 on my graphics accelerator, so here, if you buy this card, it'll take you up to a 4.0 on your graphics acceleration score. Well, if you don't see the problem with this, I mean, does anybody remember when they embedded Internet Explorer into the operating system and didn't let anybody else install anything? And the lawsuits and the problems that came out of that? This is not something that you can't bundle this kind of thing. This
I
is
do,
a problem.
I do, but let's go play devil's advocate for a second and think about how long Apple used proprietary power supplies and even memory.
Well,
and they were allowed to, I believe. I don't think that was ever broken by law.
But did they... Buying it only from them is something that I've always hated about Apple. I've made no bones about that, and a lot of people, they are...
And they sued clones and Apple clone sellers and things like that.
It's not... Yeah, but these are not Microsoft... See, they're selling Apple-branded products for the Apple computer. This is Microsoft selling not only Microsoft software, but they're selling NVIDIA hardware. They're selling a no-name power supply. They're selling a third-party antivirus.
Now that's a completely different point. You're right.
Yeah, I mean it's really potentially a problem, especially integrating it. It's not a problem if they. Well, I'll tell you one other thing. I think it's Windows Media Player 11, 12. I don't know what the hell that's up to. The one that
by
comes
Music Link. I saw that as well.
The one that comes with this one. Well, they did that one a little bit differently. This one is not so bad. It's a cool idea that if you're listening to music, whether it's streaming through a radio station, whatever, it tells you the artist and it gives you an option to click here to buy it. That can be really cool if it gives you a bunch of options, kind of like a price watch, but right on your desktop. If I can click on music I'm listening to and like, and it says, and I right click and it says, oh, so Amazon has it for this price, and CD Now has it for this price, and so-and-so has it for this price, et cetera, that's cool to me. That's a price marketing, price search engine built into it. That's a cool thing. And Windows Media Player allows those plugins to happen. This application, however, does not. It goes only to Windows Marketplace. So places like Newegg, places like, well, you know what, even Bricks and Mortars, even CompUSA, CompUSA, which I couldn't care less if they died anyway, but all these stores that sell these things, they're going to be very angry because somebody sitting at home can now click on a link that's embedded in the operating system, and I don't care what you say, that is an unfair advantage that takes you to the Windows Marketplace and buy it from Microsoft. Microsoft is now in the reselling computer peripherals business? Are you kidding me? I see a huge fallout from this coming up. I see a huge lawsuit coming. If they leave this in and don't make it so that other people can put their... If it had an option that says, you know, price compare it and see it from these top retailers, where anybody could participate or something like that, that might be different, but I don't think that's going to happen.
Well, smart business decision if that is the case, that this is just a free beta. I don't think they can get in trouble for doing it with a free beta yet. If there's an uproar, they can pull that, I believe.
Yeah, I don't
probably
think...
Probably have trouble-free.
Yeah, I don't think they can get any problems right now with the beta, but yeah, that's something they better... And I'm surprised I haven't seen more mention of that out on the interweb somewhere. I would think that, like, Slashdotters would be all over that kind of stuff, but what do I know? Anyway...
Yeah, I'm not a monopoly law expert, so it may very well be within the law.
Yeah, I doubt it.
Maybe why we're not seeing anything. I doubt it. But
I doubt it very seriously.
I don't know.
Well, we'll see what kind of, mark my words, let's see what kind of fallback comes out of that one. Now, I've been bogarting most of the show here talking about some of my findings. Now, what kind of stuff have you been playing with the new Vista?
Well, what I did is on the Beta 2 machine at work, today I spent a little time watching a webcast from Microsoft, and I spent a little time reading a document that they released, which is called the Microsoft Vista... I forget the name of it. It's a 60-megabyte file. It's big, and it's a DOC format file. They have a 12-megabyte one, which is in ASPX format. A lot smaller, but I didn't grab that one. I grabbed the doc file. Mm-hmm. It's actually a decent file. It actually explains Windows pretty well. The webcast was informative. The webcast I'll talk about first. That was a webcast on something called WIM, which is the Windows imaging format. It's basically like what Ghost does. Images, hard drives for deployment.
Wow, and that comes bundled with
this comes bundled with I think it was only Windows Vista Enterprise, if I remember correctly.
Oh, okay. But that is a cool app. Now, where does that leave a company like Ghost, though? Or like Semantic Ghost?
Well, let me tell you, if from what I understand about the webcast is going to be true, I mean, who knows, it could be well overblown and not as great as it's cracked out to be. I haven't used it yet. I don't think anybody has. I don't know. Probably someone has, but definitely not me. But from what I see, it makes Ghost pale in comparison.
Wow.
For quite a few reasons. You can edit your image without ever booting into it. In other words, patch the image while it's just an image.
Wow, that's kind of cool.
That's definitely cool. You can patch the image without even, you know, booting into it, without uploading patches, things like that. You can download a patch and apply it without ever using it. Things like that, like what I wonder about WIM is... Another aspect of it is, like, let's say it's hardware agnostic. It's, like, hardware independent. You can use that image. Another reason why it's going to maybe be bad for Norton Ghost, you know, you can take this image that you make and deploy it onto any machine. I can use the same image on my NS7S with a 9600 Radeon card that you used on your machine.
Okay.
In other words, like, if you do an XP image, you have to have the exact same hardware to put it onto another machine.
Right, right.
This is different. You don't need to do that.
All right, what about the key?
I guess the key, using the Enterprise Edition, I'm going to go out on a limb and say it's probably similar to corporate where you're not using a key.
Gotcha.
The XP corporate copy.
Gotcha, okay. Yeah, that's kind of cool, too, that you can, you know... The way it is right now in a lot of labs is they have all their images, that's fine, but then as new service packs and updates come out, they have to then take an image, update it, and re-image it with those new updates on there, or stick with their old image, and then when they put it on a new box, update it.
After you image it onto a drive, start patching away.
Yeah, so, I mean, either way, it defeats the point. You're not saving time, a whole lot of time anymore by doing that.
Or you're constantly building images.
Right, right. And, you know, Ghost will still have its place as far as maybe Linux, but, you know, other operating systems. I'm sure this thing will only work with Windows.
It does only work with Windows.
So there's
And
still...
I got to tell you, they definitely didn't mention this in the webcast that I'm watching, but as I'm watching, you know, them talk about hardware independence and modifiable without booting into, the first thing I thought was Windows corporate copyright infringement times 10. Mm. One image gets out as a torrent. It works on any computer in the world.
Right.
I mean, I could be wrong. They may have made it harder than that. but they made it sound so simple that it might literally be that simple.
Wow.
The copyright infringed Vista.
Well, that'll be interesting to watch and see how that plays out. I'm sure it calls back to home somehow. Like I said, it'll be interesting for somebody to do some captures. I had hoped to have someone on the show that might have already been doing some of that stuff, but wasn't able to get a hold of him. So hopefully somebody will do some capturing and see what's coming to and from those boxes. It's kind of hard to do it. I'd like to see what's happening during the install. I actually unhooked mine and had it standalone, no communication with the global interweb while I was doing my install, because I didn't want anything reported. I didn't know what it was doing. I didn't want to activate an only key that I had in case I wanted to put it on a different box later. So it'll be interesting to see what kind of information is coming in and out.
Absolutely. There's a lot more. They were definitely free in their document that I downloaded reading about. There's tons of communication home for all kinds of things. You know, like I said, one of the big ones they're trying to push is, you know, user feedback type stuff.
Right.
It's the document's riddled with it. You know, please use your user feedback, blah, blah, blah.
Right. Yeah, they want someone else to do their work, debugging work for them.
Right.
All right, so what else do you find out?
I went to the CIO's desk and talked to him for a little while because he has it installed on his laptop.
Ooh, interesting.
And what he was telling me and what he showed me was basically, I hear a little bit of controversy about it, but he showed me the BitLocker feature, which seems pretty cool, I gotta say. You know,
what is that?
It's full drive encryption. And what it does is it does something that Windows didn't do for XP in 2000. It encrypts the whole volume, and it encrypts the system files and hibernation files on a separate partition from the, you know, profiles and other things like that.
Wow, that's
profiles,
really cool.
Things like that. So system files have to be on a separate partition to use BitLocker.
Hmm.
He said something about BitLocker needed to have a management console to work well with BitLocker for end users to have it seamless. In other words, so that they don't even know it's there.
Mm-hmm.
That, I forget exactly the word that he used for the management console, but there is a management console that you have to use in conjunction with it so that users will never even know it's there. It's a full volume encryption, encrypts the system files separate from data.
Very cool. That's something that I would make really good use of. I would use that a lot on my laptops especially.
Yeah, so you have to have the Trusted Platform Module chip.
Hmm, interesting.
Which is, you know, kind of controversial if you read some of the stuff on Slashdot or whatnot.
Yeah.
But that's required for BitLocker to run.
Yeah, for a business machine, though, I think I would be okay with it in that particular application.
Absolutely.
All right.
Yeah, it makes encryption easy. Anything that makes encryption easy in business, you know, so that it doesn't have to be done on the SAN is good.
Right, right. I may not feel, you know, privacy aspects of it aside, you know, it's a business machine anyway. The fact that I'd have a drive encrypted if I lost it in an airport or got it stolen or something like that, that data, the privacy aspect of losing a lot of the data that I have on there is more
right.
so than that chip, so.
Right, which is, you know, easy for us to do on our own right now. But
right.
it's not absolutely easy for somebody who doesn't have a lot of technology to do on an XP machine.
Right.
It's full volume encryption is hard to do.
All right.
In XP, anyway.
Right.
Seems to be a little easier in Vista from what they're saying.
All right, that's a cool step in the right direction.
It definitely is. There's other ones for end users. You know, Restart Manager is something that's going to cut down on restarting of the machine, which is... You know, everybody's big complaint about XP. Every time I do an update, I need to restart. Well, I hear that, you know, this document says that Vista is going to cut down on the amount of restarts required.
They lied.
No. They lied.
They lied. I already had one the first time I updated it. It had to restart itself.
Yeah, I mean, what else is new? I mean, I guess it's all new code. They should have rewritten it differently since it's not based on the old code, but... Evidently, if it requires restarts at all, except for, you know, what would be the kernel update is kind of stupid, but...
Yeah, I think it had one major update when, you know, it's just
then
installed.
Again, it may have been a major update. It may have been an update to the kernel, so...
Yeah, I guess it could have. It's only been out for, what, a couple weeks, a month maybe.
Right.
So there's already had a security flaw that critical that they had to patch the kernel.
In a beta install.
Sounds about right, though. All right, so what else you got?
Let's see, other cool stuff. Program Compatibility Assistant. That is different than what's in XP. The XP compatibility is backwards compatible with a lot of different stuff.
Right.
This is different because it's all new code. It couldn't be just automatically backwards compatible. Okay. But even better than that, it's backwards compatible with 9X, it's backwards compatible with XP, and it's backwards compatible with 2000, all without user intervention. There is a thing called Program Compatibility Assistant in the control panel. Mm-hmm. Which you can use to use it basically as a wizard where you can make a program that's, say, Windows 98. It runs on 98, McAfee for 98.
Right.
You can take that and use the Program Compatibility Assistant wizard to make that compatible with Vista. The inner workings of how that's doing that, I don't know yet. But it's supposed to be any average Joe can do this.
And I don't know that I trust a virus scanning engine from 7 years ago, 8 years
ago. Well, no, that was a pretty stupid analogy, but there, you know, let's say you had your cabinet-making program that only runs on 9X.
There you go. Gotcha. Or if I wanted to pay, like, Commander Keen or something like that.
Exactly.
I could run it back under DOS mode, and which, yeah, that never did work quite right in XP, so it'll be interesting to see how it runs in this in Vista.
Yeah, theoretically, they're going to be able to make this compatible without, you know, sacrificing all the security advances that they worked on Vista to do. So that's a good thing, to be able to run 9X apps without having to run under FAT32.
Right. Yeah, and that's another disappointment, actually, since you mentioned FAT32 and the file systems in general, is that they did not get WinFS rolled out in time to be included in Vista. That's a big disappointment.
Yep, noticeable glare. They, you know, they took a hit on the chin for that one all over the place. It was pretty much all over the internet.
So it's more NTFS.
It's all NTFS, yeah.
Yeah. All right. And actually, isn't there also, I tried to find some of this on just using it myself, that it's a little bit more Unix-like in its controls. I know somebody in IRC was telling me that. And I had heard and read that, but when I actually tried to sit down in the box myself and try to view it, like I looked at the properties in Explorer, and it'll tell me in the bottom right-hand corner, public has R read-only privileges to the file. Well, the simple fact that it said public tells me that maybe it has changed a little bit, but I couldn't see all of them like I can see in Unix. I couldn't see all of the file controls for all the different groups.
It's still using NTFS permissions. Now, I could be wrong, but...
Well, that's what I'm saying. It seems like it would have to, but on the other hand, I couldn't tell why it was able to tell me this public and read-only format. So, unless it was just saying, you know, that the attribute plus R, if that's all it was trying to say.
Right.
But...
And which is probably what it was doing. It's probably just another different way of going to, you know, advanced permissions. And you know, it might just automatically show the advanced permissions instead of the, you know, just simple read-only permission.
Well, if it is going in that Unix-like direction, I mean, it's kind of interesting. The theme that I've heard now listening is they're stealing a lot of ideas from Mac OS X. They're stealing some ideas from Linux, Unix world, from open source apps.
Well, not only did they miss out on their... you know, WinFS implementation. They missed out on the scripting language implementation that was supposed to go in there.
Really? I did not hear that one.
Well, remember, they were supposed to do a big scripting language into Windows.
Right. I did not hear that they had dropped it, though.
Don't think they dropped it, but it hasn't been included yet. I don't think it definitely wasn't included in Beta 1. Now, I don't think that's in Beta 2 either.
All right. I'm going to have to go look for that one.
Yeah, the scripting language that they wanted to include was not ready for Beta 1. I know that.
You know, and I actually have a beta of the WinFS, the Windows file system. I actually have a separate disk with the WinFS on it. I might try to throw that on this box and then run Vista under it just to see if it works and if it acknowledges it and if there's any difference. That could be interesting.
Speaking of how we were just going into Unix-type stuff, they have a new Unix subsystem.
What do you mean
which
by subsystem?
I mean, if anybody remembers POSIX, which is their old, you know, POSIX subsystem. Well, let's say, let me look here. I wrote down a quote from Microsoft on this. The Unix subsystem and its accompanying utilities provide customers with an environment that resembles any other Unix system. Those are big words.
Yeah. Okay.
I do know that the subsystem only runs on SCOs, SVR5, and on BSD. Supposedly, it only supports those two environments.
Hmm. Now, why
applications that would run natively under those environments, I should say.
Now, see, why single out those two?
I don't know. I don't have a good answer for that. I when I saw that, it jumped off the page at me, and I almost laughed out loud. You know, I went, wow, you know, they're only supporting SCOs, Unix, and BSD. That's kind of odd.
Does it have anything to do with the fact that maybe they're avoiding, like, the free distributions, like FreeBSD, OpenBSD, or whatever, Linux, stuff like that? They're
didn't elaborate enough on BSD to know. I mean, do they mean, you know, the BSD old 4.4, or do they mean FreeBSD, any BSD code? I don't know that. I do know that, obviously, SCO Unix isn't free.
Right, right. But
so,
but they didn't mention, for example, Solaris, which also, well, actually, isn't the newest, didn't they release a version of Solaris that was free recently, 10, I thought?
Yes.
But still, you'd think they might have support for other Solarises in there.
You would think they'd support Solaris and Linux if they wanted to offer true compatibility to you know, enterprise users. They're both big. They're way bigger than SCO.
Yeah, I mean, Solaris would be a huge thing. Well, all right, I'm not sure what they're thinking on that one, but okay, whatever, Microsoft. Good try.
Neither do I, but supposedly their new subsystem is going to allow Unix-based tools that can recompile Unix-based applications to run natively on Windows. And it's going to offer all the command line tools for a Unix environment. That's what they're saying.
I wonder if it has anything to do with the licensing of that they're charging money for this operating system, and they can't include something that was under the GPL. I don't know.
The BSD license is different than the GPL, and I actually just Yachty say something not long ago, and I mean, he knows more about licenses than me, and he said something along the lines of where you can take BSD code, alter it slightly, and re-release it without releasing the source.
Right.
That's perfectly acceptable under the BSD code.
Right, and that's why I'm wondering, that's the reason maybe the Linux and other support is not there, because so much of that code is GPL'd, and therefore Microsoft might not be able to release it without releasing the source code to it, and maybe that's
why...
That has to be
the reason.
But again, I'm just thinking out loud here, so we could be way off on that. So what else you got?
Not much on deployment, not much on basically the enterprise stuff, just what I talked to my CIO about, you know, my other admin, my project manager. Basically, we talked a lot about WIM. It's supposed to be big. It's going to change the way networks are deployed in the enterprise.
And what is this?
WIM is the Windows Imaging Format I was talking about before.
Oh, okay, yeah, they mentioned earlier. Yeah,
it's
going
to definitely change it. I don't see any reason why my, you know, entity, I don't see any reason why anyone would be using Ghost in an environment if the things they're saying are true. It's just dumb to still use Ghost, and it's probably not going to be used anymore.
Well, and I think there's going to be a lot of fallout when the time comes, not only from that. Well, again, Ghost can be used with imaging any other thing besides Microsoft, whereas Microsoft's tool is going to be Microsoft only. But let's be honest, most people are using it because they've got a Windows lab in their university or business or whatever the case may be, and they've got 100 Windows boxes that they're imaging. That's what the majority of people are using it for. So it's going to hurt not only... Okay, that's just one example. That's just one interesting thing. Okay, the fact that it comes with a mail and calendar client is interesting, because there are, you know, lots of third-party mail applications like Eudora and Thunderbird is what I use, of course, and the stuff that it's bundling with the operating system. Not only that, but then you've got that Windows One Care, which does not come... I didn't see that with the Vista, but it's something else that they're also rolling out right now, where it comes with virus protection, spyware scanning, phishing toolbar stuff, which is built into IE7, a lot of third-party vendors, a lot of third-party companies that make third-party software for Windows are suddenly going to be out of business because Microsoft's bundling a lot of stuff in the operating system. Now, I don't know. That's not necessarily. I'm not even going to touch that really. Whether that's good or bad, I don't know. That's you know, what are you going to do? Is it unfair of them to give those to its users who buy the operating system for free? Is there a problem with Microsoft giving me a mail client, a calendar software, and this stuff in my operating system? And do these other companies have a right to cry foul about that? I don't know.
Well, what's funny about that is the business pragmatist in me says no, they don't have any right to cry about it.
I mean, Mac, like you said earlier, Mac has gotten away. Mac has done that. They've had it with it for a long time. That's not, you know, I don't think there's anything wrong with bundling certain applications as long as you're not preventing other applications from entering the fray and competing fairly. And that
right.
goes
or
back
making
to
making it hard to remove Windows components, you know, like
right.
Messenger and things like that.
Exactly, exactly. So,
but
all right,
it's,
well.
Vista's going to definitely catch on. I mean, you know, enterprises are going to want to use Vista. They actually were very smart by making it, you know, HAL independent. For people that don't know what that is, it's hardware abstraction layer. You know, you can check out what one yours is by going into the device manager and checking out which HAL you're using, which XP is using a HAL. If you have one of those, you're using a hardware abstraction layer. Now, Vista isn't using that, which is why the Windows imaging format can work with any hardware because it's HAL independent.
Gotcha. All right,
and
well,
just
I think
for
that's
that very reason, it's obviously going to be used. Like, people that, enterprises that would have never upgraded from XP because it works perfectly fine are going to save a lot of money on imaging and deploying. And, you know, when you want to add, large enterprises want to add a whole new building, it will take a day instead of a long time.
Right.
Switching to Vista saves them money now.
Yeah, but I guess to wrap it all up, though, from our standpoint, I personally, well, I've got it, so I'll upgrade a couple boxes to it just because I have it for free anyway. I have it paid for and covered legally. So I'll probably run a couple boxes like this. But if I were a home user and had to pay for it, there's just not nearly enough in Windows Vista, based on what I've seen in this beta, to justify me upgrading from Windows XP. I just really don't
see
it.
No, there's definitely not. I don't think they're shooting for the home crowd yet. I think they're depending on the home crowd to start to catch on to Vista in 2008, end of 2008. People start to buy it just as people started to buy XP in droves in 2002, 2003.
Well, and they're going to release multiple versions of Vista. There's a home version, there's a pro version, there's a media center version. I think there's even a gaming version, and then there's a, I don't know what they call it, but I think isn't there like a, let's call it
the enterprise version. Like, that Unix subsystem only comes on the enterprise version.
I think there's like a thin
client.
I know
that
client.
For sure. The Unix subsystem, whatever that's going to be, is enterprise only.
Right, yeah. Enterprise, of course, is going to be their high end. But I think there's also one really low end that does not have all the bells and whistles and apps. It's just a very watered down, like, let's call it thin client, for lack of a better word, a very thin
right.
client.
The Windows
version.
Server 2003 Web Edition version.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Which only uses up to 2 gigs of memory. But anyway, we won't go there. All
yeah.
right, well, I think that's pretty much going to wrap it up. We spent like an hour on this, so let's get another quick view on it and talk about one other topic from the forums and then probably do some email. So, Right Coast, thank you for being on the show, and we're going to head off and see what Knot Theory has to say about the whole thing.
Thank you. See you soon.
All right, so next up on tonight's Microsoft Vista Beta 2. Do we call it Windows Vista Beta 2? Is that the proper term?
I have no idea.
Well, anyway, but for those of you who recognize the voice, Knot Theory is on the line with us tonight.
I'm in the easy.
All right, so we're going to actually, you're going to probably have the last word on this. So what did you think in your, now you used it kind of differently than everyone else. You did it in a virtual session, right?
Yeah, I'm special. My mom always said I was special, so I do things in special ways. So I installed Vista into VMware. And, you know, other than the installer running in 16-color mode, once you get it up and running and you install VMware tools, it runs just fine. It's not super fast because Vista is so dependent on your graphics accelerator to do everything, because
yeah.
everything's got to be rounded and shiny and all kinds of stuff. So it's a little sluggish, but I have to say my absolute favorite thing about Windows Vista, and I'm sure you can tell I'm not being serious now, is Internet Explorer. And I'll tell you why.
Oh,
okay?
Yeah.
They came up with this new technology called tab browsing. I still don't understand it yet, but it's magic.
It's a new technology. It's going to take time for you to catch on to that.
Yeah, you know, you can't get used to it right away. You know, it's a total shift in the way people use browsers. So anyway, seriously, the best thing about Internet Explorer in Vista is that on my computer, the only website I can go to is Google.
Yeah, now see, I don't know what's up with that, because I didn't have any problems like that. I saw you mention that in the forums, but I didn't have any problems. I had one funny problem. I installed Microsoft Office, which I was going to talk about a little bit maybe later. And when Office installs, the first thing, like when it's done installing, it says, do you want to go to the website to look for updates or something like that? And you say, okay, or you say, no, finish installing or something like that. And when you go to that website, it tells you that you're not authorized to go to that website. You have to actually activate the damn thing.
Hmm.
Other than that, though, I didn't have any problem going to any other site.
Well, I only tried a few sites. I tried Google, of course. Google worked, but not the first time, only the second time. Then I decided, okay, well, if other websites aren't coming up, let me go to Microsoft's webpage and see if their website at least comes up. The only thing that comes up on the Microsoft page for me is the top bar that says Microsoft. Not even all the navigation comes up. And then it pops up this little message that says that the phishing filter has been activated, which is pretty cool.
Yeah.
And then when I try to go to Slashdot, the only thing I can get on Slashdot is the title bar. Like it says Slashdot News for Nerds, and then the screen is black.
That's strange. Is it a rendering issue?
No, I mean it's not even downloading the whole web page. It's got that little progress bar on the bottom, and every time you reload it, it gets a little bit further, but it never gets all the way, and it never renders anything.
Wow, that's really weird.
Yeah, it's pretty strange. I didn't really try to do anything else other than use Internet Explorer, and I didn't really want to bother to install any applications. But I don't know, it didn't really wow me. Like nothing made me think like people are going to need Vista because it has this feature. You know, I couldn't put my finger on anything that it's going to have. Like, you know, you can turn off the themes and all that other nonsense so it looks just like regular Windows. So it's not like they've really changed the user interface very much at all. You know, they haven't made it completely different. So I don't know what all the fuss is about.
Well,
all I know is that it's really heavy on my graphics card.
I was getting ready to say that. You mentioned it. You kind of buzzed by it earlier, but let's back up. Actually, let's back up two steps. The install process itself. You briefly mentioned the install process. You said 16 colors. Did you install... Now, installing it on a virtual session like you did, does that... Basically, it's like installing it on a fresh, brand-new hard drive for the first time, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, now, what I did is I actually upgraded, or I actually fired the installer, I should say, to set up from inside of a Windows XP box that I already had installed. So, of course, it restarted and rebooted from the CD and did the install. But it was pretty much a hands-off experience. It did not prompt me for a lot of things. And I thought that was probably because it pulled a lot of the settings from the previous version of Windows somehow.
Yeah.
Did you have any?
I was actually going to say that this is absolutely by far the most hands-off Windows install ever. And it was fast. Even on my little VMware session that I only had 512 megs of RAM allocated to, and, you know, it flew. You know, I think it only took, like, maybe 10 minutes to install. It was super fast. And it asked me, like, three things. It asked me what my name was, what the name of the computer should be, and what time zone I was in. I don't think it asked anything else at all.
Now, you were using the Beta 2, the 1.3 gigabytes? Is that how big the file was?
I thought it was, like, the 3 gigabyte or something.
Was it 3 point something?
I thought it was 3.something.
I don't
know. 4, maybe, something like that.
Yeah, now that
I got it from Microsoft. I got it legit.
Okay, so it's definitely the Beta 2, the latest one that came out.
Yeah.
All right, well, I know what the killer app is. I know what you said there was nothing on there. Dude, you didn't check out the new screensavers.
Oh, wow, that's a good call. I don't think I did.
Dude, they have new 3D screensavers that are like direct 3D enabled or something. I don't know what I'm talking about. They had some new screensavers on there. That was pretty much the highlight of it for me.
Wow. Wait, did they bring back Pipes from Windows XP?
Pipes never went away. Pipes has always been around.
Oh, really? Yeah, that shows you how much I use Windows. I thought it was gone.
Oh, no. Pipes is the bomb. Especially if you sit there and watch it and wait for that little teacup to pop up in random mode. But anyway, that's a whole nother story. Anyway, I actually... And this other thing you mentioned that I wanted to agree with is the stupid graphics accelerator deal. I don't have an accelerator card of any kind in my machine. So I don't get any of those pretty glass, arrow, whatever the hell the thing is called. I don't have any special effects. It pretty much looks and acts like regular Windows XP as far as the interface. I mean, it's a little bit different, but not too awful much.
Right. Yeah, the Arrow Glass thing is just, it's, you know, I really thought it was going to be somewhat of a different user interface, but it's like, it's rounded and it's shiny, and maybe there are a few things that are a little different, but it's the same old minimize, maximize, close nonsense. And it just, it makes it so heavy that there's no reason that I want to use it.
So it's flare is what you're saying. They have the requisite amount of flare.
Yeah, they have like, I mean, they have like 95 pieces of flare when they really only need 12.
Yeah, but you don't want to have the minimum flare now, do you?
Yeah, what do you think about somebody who has just the minimum of, you know, amount of flare to get by?
I want you to want more flare.
Doesn't Microsoft want to express itself?
I think, wasn't that the slogan at one time, express yourself or something, Microsoft?
Oh, I don't know. That's like a cheesy .com. Like, everybody is like, express yourself. Fucking petfood.com.
Express yourself. Oh, man.
Oh, man, I made it through this whole thing without cursing except once, I think. Damn.
Ah, well, we don't care about that anyway. Of course, the listeners might hear a little wind whistling by or something as you're recording this episode while driving through, I don't know where you're driving through.
I'm driving through Westchester County.
Is that an undisclosed, okay, you're going to drop docks?
Yeah, what? It's my docks. I live in Westchester County. What's anybody going to do about it? Come
yeah, what up?
Something of it.
What up, bitch? Oh, shit.
Yeah, unfortunately, it's raining, so I can't really drive very fast like I want to in my new car.
I was just waiting, not for the spontaneous cursing of on during the recording. I was waiting for you to curse at another driver who cuts you off or gets in the slog in front of you in the fast lane or something like that.
Man, how about this moron who's doing 20 miles an hour in front of me right now? God.
Oh,
and driving one of these stupid, I don't even know what the term for it is. It's one of these trucks where it's got, like, the bed in the back, but you can, like, open it up. It's kind of like the pickup truck equivalent of a convertible. Like, you can take this panel out of the back and,
yeah, is that
and
like
either
that avalanche
bed or not. It's really stupid. I don't know why anybody buys a truck like that. It's got to be the dumbest thing in the world. Especially if you live where I live, like, you're not hauling lumber or anything, moron. You're taking your kids to soccer.
Maybe.
Anyway.
Well, is that,
yeah,
like the Chevy Avalanche or something, I think, is that... you know why they drive that? That's the closest thing we have to a Transformer so far. The closer and closer we get to a Transformer, the more and more people will buy it. I'd buy a Transformer, wouldn't you?
You know, I probably would. If it was like, I forget what show this was or what cartoon this was, but back in the day there was a guy who had a motorcycle that turned into a hovercraft.
Hmm.
And it was just the coolest thing ever. If they had that, bet your ass I'd
buy
it.
Oh, shit, I'm all over it.
I'm all over it.
Yeah, but when would I not...
I'm all over it like white on rice.
When would I not hover, though, is the question. I mean, if it's a hovercraft and a bike, I'd be hovering all the time. Who doesn't
hover? No. I wouldn't be hovering all the time. I would get up next to people and race them around a little bit until they thought they were real hot stuff, and then I would hover, and it'd be game over.
Well, what does this have to do with Windows Vista? Not a damn thing. But we're going to...
Well, yeah, basically, my verdict on Windows Vista is that, honestly... Until somebody shows me what's special about it, I'm not even going to bother to boot it anymore.
Hmm. Well, he has spoken. Actually, this turned into like an episode of Default Radio there for a few minutes. All right, well, there's one more thing I want to talk about while I got you on the phone, because you boned me last week. We were going to do this last week. There's one other thread in the forums that you're the person to answer this question. There was a thread in the forums about... people were throwing around these ridiculous numbers, I thought anyway, of how many phone numbers there are available in the United States, how many total official available phone numbers there were for distribution, or even potentially, I wasn't even sure, the question was kind of vague, but how many valid phone numbers are possible in the United States? So I looked at the math, and I have said many times I'm not a big phone guy, but it didn't even look remotely close. So you're the man. What do you think about this? How many possible phone numbers are there and valid phone numbers in the United States right now?
Well, you know, this is like the third or fourth time this has come up, and a long time ago when it first did come up, I took the developed my database, and I made a little script that would go and count the number of assignable exchanges that there were in the U.S., and then just multiply it by, you know, 10,000, so that you could find out how many numbers were available and what percentage of it you had used up. And I think, I want to say that there's 288,000 exchanges in Nampa, but only 140,000 of them are assigned.
What? Yeah, so, 136,027, according to you.
There you go.
Okay.
So that number times, unless I'm losing my mind, that number times 10,000 is how many numbers there are assignable. I mean, obviously not counting test numbers and all that other stuff, but that's about as close as you're going to get. That's the number of numbers you can actually dial and have it do something.
So your program here does not calculate the fact that a certain block of numbers cannot be used, or certain strings or sequences of numbers cannot be used?
It does take that into account, except for, you can't really count test numbers at all. Test numbers are just assigned by the phone company randomly. There's no, like, pattern to the bulk of them. You know, some phone company may use one way to assign them, some phone company may use another, but there's no standard, so there's no real way to tell that. But it does exclude all the things that start, like, 211, 311, 411, all that stuff is excluded, because it's just the exchanges that are assigned. So technically, there are that times 10,000 assignable numbers. Whoever they're used by, I mean, I can't really give you any stats on that. But
does it
those
also
are the numbers that you can dial and that shouldn't give you some weird error message about the exchange not being assigned.
Okay, so it excludes the 411, 311, et cetera, et cetera. It also excludes the 8s?
Yeah, it excludes 8s.
Excluding 8s. So, iTinyURL this for anyone who wants to see it themselves. It is tinyURL ET, the number 2, MR, which will take you straight to this little program that Knot Theory wrote a long time ago. So check that out. But the number is, wow, there's a lot of numbers. I don't know if I can count this high. I'm going to go with, 1,360,750,000 numbers.
That's a lot of numbers.
That's a lot of numbers.
But I probably have half of them, considering how many DIDs I used to have.
Well,
apparently
you don't have enough to get something up and running, but we won't.
Yeah, that's true.
We won't go there.
I asked people on the forums. I said, if anybody has DID providers that they can recommend that are, you know, decent and let me use as many channels as I want incoming, let me know. Nobody let me know. I don't know. I have one company that I can go to that I think is okay, but other than that, I've had some pretty bad experiences. So recommend something, please. That's all I can say.
There
email me, fax me, call me, stop by my house.
At?
Let me know.
127 West Oak. No? We don't want to drop that much, Doc?
Yeah, 127 West Oak, White Plains in New York. I'm on the third floor. And it's the really short John Malkovich-style door.
Now, what's that place in Pueblo, Colorado? We should have given out that address.
Pueblo, Colorado? I don't know.
Oh, you know, the one on the commercials all the time. Damn it, am I on my own here, people? Somebody help me out. The fulfillment center in Pueblo where you get the catalogs or some shit like that. I don't know.
Never mind. Yeah, where you get all the toys and stuff?
Yeah. You know what I'm talking about. It's like slave labor, Colorado, or something like that. Child labor Avenue or something. I don't know. Whatever. All right. Well, you have to run. Is that right?
Yeah. I'm where I need to be, so I got to get out of here.
All right. Well, everybody check that out. Again, it's tinyurl.com/ET2MR. And, yes, contact him, us at the radio show. Contact you directly. What email address you want to drop?
I think, in theory, Benrod still works.
I don't even know. Let's go with that. If that doesn't work, send it to radio@binrev.com or copy us or whatever, and we'll make sure it gets into the right hands. And hopefully Freak Factor can be revived at some point in time, right?
We'll talk about it.
You love it when I put you on the spot.
Yeah, no, I have every intention of doing it. I can never guarantee any dates because they never happen.
There you go. Busy, busy man, but thank you for spending part of the day with us. And we are going to do some email now. And joining us to do our email portion of the show this week is a first-timer on Binary Revolution Radio, but someone we know very, very well. Logos X joins us on the show. Welcome, my friend.
Hey, what's up?
So, can you help me out with a little email here?
No, not a problem, man.
Okay. First thing I need you to do is sing the email theme song. No, I'm just kidding. Okay, first email this week comes from Too Geeky. Too Geeky says, Stank, I wanted to tell you I love the show and give you an extra resource to share with the other listeners. On episode 150, Freak Toolkits, it was good to hear two of my favorite hosts on the same episode, Stank and the Doctor, with the bonus of hearing Pony Boy, who is absolutely crazy. Smoke bombs, I have to see that. Yeah, I gotta see that myself. I liked the format. I think that it allows you to get a broader spectrum of content. I also like that the show is no longer live. I think it allows the guest host to be more natural and not worry about whether they should say something or not. And it allows you to have more freedom when scheduling guest hosts. Not to mention you can also scrub up any advertent doc drops. I have been going back through episodes of RFA and Default, and I have a question about general phone freaking. Oh, man. See, I don't know if I can answer this, but let's give it a shot. He says, what is so illegal other than the blue, red, and beige boxing and opdiverting? It seems to me, other than that, you are either simply using the phone, more dialing or collecting numbers, or protecting your privacy. Now, Too Geeky has... Okay, I'm going to stop the email in the middle. He goes on a little bit more. Let's stop it right there and answer that first question. And that is, what is so illegal about freaking, other than boxing? Well, boxing, of course, is the controversial part of freaking, and that's a lot of the real freaks hate referring to freaking as just getting free phone calls. It's one of the things they've always emphasized and said, that it's not about getting free phone calls. Freaking is about finding out how the phone system works. So, I do not see anything wrong with trying to understand and learn how something works. It's like anything else. It's exploring to a certain extent is fine. I can do pretty much anything I want to my own computer system, to make a metaphor into hacking. But as soon as I go, let's say I want to find out how my computer machine works, and then I go the next step further to how my router machine works, and then I want to take it outside. I mean, at some point I'm going to cross a line where I'm not supposed to be looking anymore. So I can be making phone calls and stuff like that, but as soon as I find a system out there, like, for example, a DATU, which is something that's, you know, people talk about a lot, which is a computerized system out there that lets you do some diagnostics, I'm not authorized to use something like that. So dialing a number is nothing necessarily wrong with that, but at some point you have to hang up and say, I'm not supposed to be here. And that's where that fine line gets crossed, because sometimes you don't know what it is you've dialed until it's kind of too late. So the act of phone freaking is not illegal in and of itself. Making a lot of phone calls, listening to error messages, which is another huge part of it, finding out what interactions there are between phone companies, that's all perfectly fine. I mean, unless there's something... Can you think of anything, Logos, that might be...
Besides stealing service, I think everything should be fine, you know?
Well,
if they don't have access to tattoos, then it shouldn't be there.
Yeah, but they're there for them, for authorized... It's kind of like authorized users. It's kind of like putting your computer on the interweb, and then when somebody accesses it, you're the one that put it there for whatever reason, and that doesn't mean that it's okay to hack it. That doesn't mean it's okay for somebody to have unauthorized access. So I guess there's basically two things in freaking that are dangerous or illegal. That is fraud, that is getting free phone calls of some kind, committing fraud, or committing unauthorized access of a protected system. That's the only two things I can think of that are illegal.
What about, What about, like, spoofing or something?
Well, see, the jury is still out on that one. That's a big controversy that's still ongoing. Because spoofing, the FCC regulates the telephone industry. And they require certain information to be sent through phone lines. It's in their regulations, and the phone companies have to comply with that. However, with the onset of VoIP, VoIP does not fall under FCC regulations, which is why they've been trying so hard and fighting so hard to get control of VoIP. Because if they do, then they can start controlling that. But right now, there's nothing technically illegal. Now, I'm not a lawyer, so don't take this completely to heart, but I'm pretty doggone sure that there's nothing innately illegal about spoofing a phone number when it's your system, your software, your asterisk box, your whatever, your PBX, and you're doing all the controlling. I don't think there's anything inherently illegal about that. But, again, I am not a lawyer, so I would not know for sure.
Well, that's given you're not spoofing like law enforcement.
Well, yeah, that's who you're spoofing to and what you're spoofing. You know, you don't want to mess around with 911 because that's a whole other federal jurisdiction level when you mess around with things like that. So I'm afraid that's pretty much the best answer I can give. Maybe I'll get Black Ratchet or somebody on the show in the future to follow up to this a little bit more with a little bit more detail. Now, the second part of this email goes back to episode 149. Too Geeky goes on to say, episode 149, Digital Forensics. For other listeners who might want to know more about digital forensics, they should listen to the Cyberspeak podcast at cyberspeak.libsyn.com. It is done by a couple of cybercrime investigators. I think their feed goes back to episode 1. They talk about in-case, cell phone forensics, subpoenas for information from Google, and the most recent podcast, one of the topics they discuss is how much info they can get from your RAM. Essentially, they can get a snapshot of the last application you were running. It sounded Windows-specific. It's a good listen if episode 149 got your Jones on for some digital forensics, or if you want to know how screwed you are when the hammer drops. Of course, if you hack responsibly, you will not need to worry. So, yes, Too Geeky, thank you for that email. And, again, that is cyberspeak.libsyn.com. That sounds really interesting. I'm actually going to check that one out.
One thing you said about the RAM, though, but if they can read the RAM, a lot of times when they find these boxes, they leave them on purpose to save the memory that's on the RAM.
Oh, yeah,
so
that's...
can still check through that.
Yeah, it's standard practice, because I did some research for that episode, because that is, again, that was not my forte. I'm learning a lot about that, too. Standard practice, the first thing is to not touch the computer, not turn the computer off. You know, there's a certain way, and they actually have a chart, and maybe I'll try and find that somewhere and put it on the show notes. They have a chart that you're supposed to tell what operating system it is, and it tells you the best way to shut it down so that you do not cause harm to the forensic evidence. Some operating systems, it's better to power it off, do not go through a shutdown process. Some operating systems, it's better to type in a certain command. Some operating systems, it's better to leave it on and grab an image of memory before you... There's all these different steps that they can take. So, you know what? I don't think we're going to have enough time to do any more emails tonight. I think we're going to have to wrap the show up. So, Logos X, do you have any shouts? I'll let you take first crack at shouts tonight.
Well, I got to give shouts to the BinRev 561.
Yay! My old crew at the 561 still holding it down. And since we're along the same lines, I'll give shout-outs to the BR662 meeting. All the guys at the BR662, shout-outs to them. They are having a meeting today while the show is airing. Probably in their meeting right now, probably having just nasty, wild, just buck naked, all kinds of nastiness and carrying on. And all right, maybe not. I don't know what I'm talking about. But I wouldn't put it past those guys. So, shout-outs to them. And our site of the week. Let me think. What is our site of the week? I guess, you know what? I'm going to give the site of the week to that podcast that Too Geeky just told us about, and that again is Cyberspeak, all one word, cyberspeak.libsyn.com. If you have email for us, feedback of any kind, good, bad, ugly, indifferent, something we missed, something we made a mistake, or just to tell me that I sound sexy as hell, or not, you can email us radio@benrev.com, or yell at me how I didn't even let Logosex get a word in edgewise on the show. You're going to have to come back. We're going to have you on for a longer part of the show. This was a late night, last minute fill-in last few minutes of the show tonight, so we're going to have you on an upcoming episode.
Yeah.
Closing music tonight is from Nurse Hella, and the track is called Nurse Hellamentary. Kind of a cool track with a beat from Bad Spella, good friend of MC Frontalot and several other nerdcore artists, so always putting out some cool beats, and this one is no exception, so we're going to close out with that. And Logos, thank you for helping out with the email, and to all of our other hosts tonight. And if you can help me close out the show, we'll tell everybody that we will see them next week, same hack time,
same hack channel.
This is a world premiere.
Friday night, just wanna sex me at the club. What's that a Mac with all their might? So I can spice, cause I'm so tight. Not in my black book. Well, that bite. I'll be dead when a death, they call me human traffic light. I'm kinda gang, I'm tall and pale. Watch out for me at parties, cause I tend to flail. I wail on the mic, and then it causes a scene. I'm super evil dead, so won't you hail to the queen? Bursting and curtains, there's elementary. The ultra blingin'est the MC. I'm a nerdlinger, see, but I'm precocious. Fractal macalicious, then fatality. With my Jedi mind tricks, get my VIP fix in the thick of the mix. Wanna go back to my place? Yeah. Party really licks. Got humping in the lobby, heavy bedding in the car. Play around on my court, see if you can score. Card. Start fucking, get so bored. All they do is talk and talk. They pass out, I sneak home, I can play bubble bomb. To rush, no, I ain't gonna lie. Drop science in my rhyme, doesn't fly like Bill Nye. Fuck your H2O, give me a double Coke and rye. Let's play spin the bottle. You'll look like Harry Potter. My kiss is never missed, you'll be reduced to bantha fodder. I'm like a real hot, but if I make it any hotter, I'm gonna make you cream a 90 million auto slaughter. I'm bursting and curtains, there's elementary. The ultra blinginest MC. I'm a nerdlinger, see, but I'm precocious. Fractal macalicious, then fatality.
Tell us.